Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and comics. I'm Brian.
And I'm Thor.
And I'm Jim.
Today we're sitting down with Jim Rugg, the artist on such books as Street Angel, Aphrodisiac, One Model Nation, and The Plain James. Thanks a lot for agreeing to sit down with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you are in town to talk about a new release that you have called One Model Nation. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about that book.
All right. It's about a band in the 70s in Berlin. And it's set against the backdrop of the RAF terrorist movement, which was somewhat a youth culture terrorist movement. The Bader-Meinhof Complex is a movie that documents some of the players in that was recently released. And it's about, I guess, the intersection of art and politics, in a way, because this band gets grouped with these terrorists, even though they're not involved with them in any way, except that there's overlap in the youth culture, in that a lot of the terrorists come from that youth culture, and the band is really a soundtrack of the disaffected youth of that time period.
And they end up getting used by both sides, then, the band does, because there's this feeling that the youth culture wants them to be that soundtrack and wants them to be more of an active part, but then also there's the government that kind of wants to use them for their own purposes as well.
Yeah, the band themselves are just interested in making music, right. And it's a lot about that conflict. You know, the band, one of the leaders of the band goes through some, I guess, soul searching, for lack of a better word, because he doesn't want his art or his music used in that way, but the options are just not to create any more art and music, because once he puts it out there, he can't control who likes it or who listens to it or what their beliefs are, and he doesn't want to affect their beliefs. So it's kind of interesting, you know, to get into the responsibilities, I guess, of an artist who does have a voice that people listen to, you know, big influence.
So how did you get involved in this project?
Mike Allred called me. He's friends with the original writer. It was based on a screenplay, and Mike is friends with the writer, and he read the script, and, you know, they were talking about it. And at the time, they were, I think, trying to make a film, the writer, and that had stalled, and Mike Allred read the script and thought, this is a very visual, you should think about doing this as a graphic novel. And so they went through some comics, and I guess they liked, the writer liked my work. So Mike Allred called me, and we were talking about it, and they sent me the script, and I read it, and I thought the script was very interesting, and we moved forward from there.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's kind of an interesting idea for a script, at least, that there's the writer, Albritton Taylor, who's with the Dandy Warhols, and so he's sort of the writer on it, but then there's also a researcher, if you will, who went and did a lot of the research, because this is a fictional band.
It is somewhat fictional. It's definitely composite, you know, it's definitely based on a number of real individuals. The setting is pretty highly researched.
Right.
So
how did that whole collaboration work with having, you know, a writer, but then a researcher who's trying to tie this all into reality and kind of create sort of a pastiche of I don't know, historical fiction is kind of the best way to put it.
Historical pop,
there you go. You know, and then with bands like Kraftwerk, which is sort of the template, if you will.
Pictorial historical pop fiction, maybe.
However you would like to describe it.
No one ever really refers to it that way.
But, I mean, so how did this collaboration work? I mean, what was your input into this as far as the direction or the artistic approach?
Well, they had been working on it, I think, about 5 years, the writing process and the creative process, before I was ever involved. So they had a very clear image of what they wanted. I'm not sure what the division of labor would have been between Donovan and Courtney in terms of writing the script and doing the research and stuff. But once I got involved, I would start doing samples, and they would send, Donovan and Courtney would both send me samples. I think Mike probably sent me references, And they were anything from their own photographs to like news photographs, video footage, whatever they happened to have. You mm-hmm. know, they would send me different fashion samples from different designers that they liked.
Oh, that's cool.
And I enjoy that part of it, so it worked mm-hmm. out really well. And it would just be a matter of, you know, incorporating some of the things that they were sending me and trying to capture Berlin mm-hmm. and capture a certain atmosphere, like an industrial. You know, like a very industrial design backdrop. And whenever, you know, I did a lot of samples, and mm-hmm. we would just talk about those and say, this works, this doesn't work, mm-hmm. try this. And if I ran into dead ends, you know, I would tell them that, and they would send me more reference or, you know, whatever was necessary. So it was pretty smooth in that regard. We didn't have any, there was nothing that they disagreed on that mm-hmm. was like, a fight of how are we going to draw this or anything. So, it, you know, that my contribution was strictly visual, mm-hmm. and it was pretty clear. They definitely had, what I found is working with art directors, working with editors and writers, the more clear the vision of the person I'm working with, you know, if I'm doing like mm-hmm. one for hire, the better the process. The worst case scenario is when somebody isn't sure what they want, and you end up giving them samples and they just don't know what they want, and you end up redrawing things over and over. With these guys, it was a matter of just getting it right.
Right.
And once that happened, they knew it, you know, they made it mm-hmm. clear, and they were very articulate in what they were looking mm-hmm. for. So it was pretty easy to adjust things.
You know, before we started recording, you were talking about music a little bit, and you said that you like to listen to a lot of just what people send you. Was there sort of a soundtrack that was going on in the background while you were doing this? Were they sending you musical samples or?
I listened to a bunch of the Dandy Warhol material, which really wasn't relevant to this mm-hmm. project. That was mostly just to get familiar with Courtney.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to a bunch of Kraftwerk, mm-hmm. which was, I guess, one of the bands from that era that mm-hmm. would have been influential whenever they were writing the book. And, That was probably the extent of it. I'm mm-hmm. really terrible whenever it comes to music. Uh-huh. I listen to a lot more podcasting and NPR and interviews and mm-hmm. DVD commentaries and stuff like that when I'm working than I do music.
Gotcha. So this book seemed to follow some of the themes that I've seen in some of your other books, in that, like, the Plain Janes deals with a group of girls who engage in what some people would consider terrorist or counter-culture activities.
Yeah, I thought I made that connection.
You know, Street Angel deals with a protagonist, very anti-establishment, but also kind of caught in the middle, the way that I saw the characters from, you know, One Model Nation, caught in the middle of, you know, all these people that want her to sort of be something for them. And so I was just curious if this is something that appeals to you, that sort of idea of striking out against this, or am I just reading too far into your work here?
It's a good observation. It's something mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you just described it, it reminds me that as a cartoonist or as an illustrator, mm-hmm. I feel that way sometimes. Anytime you create something that people are going to read, listen to, watch, once it's out there and once they're receiving it, they kind of finish that,
right?
You know, and it's not a complete work until they react to it. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's complete whenever I'm done with it, it's a diary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it wasn't a conscious theme, but mm-hmm. That's interesting. I started this right after the third Jane's book was canceled. Well, not right after, but, you know, a month or two after.
Right.
Enough that was still what was fresh in my head, and I had done the Jane's for a couple of years immediately before this book. And so the book was a reaction for part of the my interest was that it was very different than the Janes.
Right.
You know, it was no longer a young adult setting. Mm-hmm. It was more of, you know, a growing up, slightly more adult. Mm-hmm. You know, the protagonists are still young men.
Right.
It's definitely set in a youth culture, but not the same as a young adult novel.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, it definitely has a different feel to it, but I just noticed this sort of theme that, you know, yeah, it's people, the youth striking out against sort of this establishment or this, I don't know, people who want them for some particular purpose.
Yeah, it's true. You know, commercial art, that's something that we deal with on everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any kind of commercial venture, somebody has some idea of how they want it to
right.
work, and you're giving them you're helping them achieve that goal, you know.
Right, and how much of your ideals do you hold on to, and how much are you willing to compromise and bend?
Yeah, and an interesting thing with One Model Nation is the Nazi undertones. Mm-hmm. You know, the one character's father was a Nazi, mostly to protect his family, didn't have a choice.
Right.
And you see a lot of the big companies that worked with the German government during World War II, like IBM or, you know, Hugo Boss or someone like that. Mm-hmm. And people try not to dwell on that now, but as a, you know, as a freelancer, it's something I think about. You know, I'm asked to draw things, and sometimes it may not be for a company that I want to buy their products.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the interesting things, is that this One Model Nation is it's kind of a multimedia experience, that you have the book One Model Nation. If you go to the One Model Nation website, there is a music video there for One Model Nation, the band. And then there's also a 30-second commercial for Volkswagen, I believe, that used a One Model Nation song. And then apparently there's also several songs that were written sort of, you know, in the One Model, you know, for the One Model Nation band. And so it's kind of interesting that you've got this multimedia experience going on based around this.
Yeah, I love the music that they've done so far that I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting to me. And I like how they've used it. Like that Volkswagen commercial is amazing to me, you know, just as a video, if I saw it by itself. In a way, I almost think it's better than the book. You know, it's very succinct. Mm-hmm. It's very effective. It's evocative of that period. It just works well.
Right. And again, it goes back to that whole idea of, you put something out there for commercial purposes and you're not sure how it's going to be used. You're not sure what's going to happen with it. And yeah, the One Model Nation it's very difficult in the sense that, yeah, you have these kids who are growing up and they are the children of people who were on both sides of that war, and they're stuck in the middle as their country is trying to deal with, you know, growing out of that and moving away from it. So it was a really interesting place to be, sort of stuck in the middle there.
Yeah, and outside the narrative, I like the idea of the multimedia approach of mm-hmm. having this music, you know, that exists, and having a comic book that tells part of their story, and having fragments of art and video and things. It's very immersive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you enter this world because you find the music or you find the book attractive, that's the kind of experience I tend to enjoy with entertainment, where you can kind of keep going and, you know, keep seeing more and uncovering more of it, get as involved as you want to get.
Right.
And I don't think everybody enjoys that, but if you do, it's available. And if you don't, you know, hopefully the book is very satisfying on its own, or the music's very satisfying, you know, if that's what you're interested in.
Right. Well, and like you said, this is a really good gateway for people who are not familiar with this time period in German history and in art and in culture. But it's a good gateway because it deals with real people and real events. And like you said, the RAF connection. You know, in researching this, it led me to this place and this place and this place. And I found myself getting deeper and deeper into the real world of, you know, late 70s Germany through, you know, a late 2009 graphic novel.
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm a big history fan, and I think the only way I interact with history is through learning stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having a story that connects various historical events, you know, I can't imagine that's a bad thing for anybody. If it doesn't spark an interest in those events for those mm-hmm. people, that's fine. You know, as long as the book delivers a complete experience for them, I think that's great. And if it does connect to someone who enjoys history and is familiar with that time period, hopefully this fits in very well with the image that they have, and
mm-hmm.
maybe expands on some of those stories for them.
So, speaking of history, a little bit of a transition here.
You know what? Should we talk a little bit more about the some of the tech stuff in One Model Nation?
Please.
One of the things we did early on, we were adapting it. I work a lot with Joe Keating from Image to mm-hmm. adapt the script from a screenplay into a comic book script. And it was a very dense script. Like, mm-hmm. I went through it early on and was breaking it up and came up with, like, a lot more pages than what we had to work with. And so I talked to Joe about it. And we came up with using grids
mm-hmm.
for a couple of reasons. One is, if you're a non-comics fan, and we thought the book was going to to reach a lot of non-traditional comic book readers, maybe first-time readers, the grid would be a very easy vehicle for them to, you know, to read the comic and not get bogged down in unusual page layouts or anything. It's the first time I've worked with a grid, so I went through and looked at other comics that had grids, like Dark Knight's 16-panel grid, of course Alan Moore's 9-panel grids, or Steve Ditko, and probably people before him too. You know, I don't want to sign it, but Alan Moore's, a lot of his work is set up that way. David Lapham's Stray Bullets, the 8-panel grids, and I really enjoyed working with the grid as a cartoonist. It's something I'm sure I'm going to return to probably soon, and a lot of interesting stuff with it. We start out with a 9-panel grid in one scene, and it's a concert, and everything's going on great, and the police raid it, and it becomes very hectic with the main characters leaving, you know, racing away from the scene in a car, and the police in hot pursuit. And when that happens, we switch from the 9-panel grid to an 8-panel grid, which I believe is more cinematic. It's suddenly reading faster because you have fewer panels on a row. So little things like that were a lot of fun for me as a, you know, I don't know, a comic book nerd or as a craftsman or whatever. I just found that challenging and interesting. And the grids are so versatile in comics, and a lot of people don't use them.
Well, and it's very evocative of like the Warren Ellis's Fell, in the sense that he, when he was putting together Fell, he did the, he made a very conscious effort to have it broken down into a 9-panel grid. And then if he was going to push two of them together for exactly what you're talking about, that kind of compressed timing, but it still had to fit the same parameters. And, and it is interesting how you can play with storytelling. You can speed it up or slow it down based on the size of your grids and your panel layout. You also did a lot of vertical versus horizontal when you were laying it out. So you would have, you know, 9 panels in a traditional one, or you would have, you know, a large panel at the top and then smaller panels underneath, or sometimes you would almost rotate it where you would have smaller panels to the left side of the page, let's say, and then one long panel on the right side of the page.
I never did that.
Never did that?
I don't think so. If I do a vertical panel, I try to put it on the left side, because if you put it on the right,
when I was looking at the. So, all right.
Yeah, I don't mean to correct. No, I'm. One of the guys that I was when I started doing comics, I remember a guy talking about that, and I won't name names of the example he showed me, but he's like, "This is, you can't put the vertical panel on the right side because you read it after the first row or after the second row."
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You've got it right on the left. I'm looking there on the left.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy about it too, and we were talking about storyboards and film adaptation, and something I really want some small indie filmmaker to do is adapt a comic book and use the exact shots to set up static camera shots and use the size of the panel to dictate the length of those shots. I don't think it will work right, but I think it would be really interesting to see the results. You know, cinematography is very, a lot of cartoonists look at film as a storytelling example. It's, you know, there's tons of crossover between the two, but I think there are some fundamental differences, and I think if somebody were to film that, it would be really great. Even something like Batman Year One, which is so flawless in its, you know, in its storytelling, I would love to see what that would look like if you were to adapt it shot by shot. And just kind of see, like, I think there are some differences that are, you know, pervasive in comics, but...
So I guess that would raise the question that, have you seen the Sin City movie then? I was going to say, how do you feel that kind of transition went? Because not only did you have someone attempting to adapt something, but you also had Frank Miller, who, you know, wrote and illustrated it, you know, taking part of the helm as well. How do you feel, is that, I mean, is that kind of what you were looking at?
I think
is
it's more visual than like shot for shot, and I know they recreate panels and things. So I guess I'm thinking of it more as almost a storyboard comparison. I liked Sin City. I thought visually it was fantastic, and they did a lot of really interesting things with it, but it's not quite what I have in mind. Like Watchmen would have been the perfect opportunity, and they didn't really do it, because that one's so cinematic.
Right.
You know, the comic book, I feel like you could have really, you know, set the camera up at a medium shot, shoot those two lines of dialogue, cut to the next panel, you know, whatever it is, a close-up, longer shot. Like I said, I would just to see how it works. I don't think it will work right, but I think it would be interesting. And again, I just want to see that comparison. So.
It is interesting, and, you know, because comics are now being looked at as such a... I don't know, bridge to cinema. It's kind of like what we were talking about before we started recording about how breaking into comics these days, a lot of people want to see sort of the finished product. Like if you're a writer or an artist and you're approaching a company to work for them, unless you're an already established person, they want you to come to them with a finished product. They want to see the art and the story in one place. And comics are kind of the same way now, that Hollywood's looking at them as a storyboard almost, that we can see how this story is going to look and how it's going to play out. But then they go and change it.
I've known a number of people who have adapted. They've made comics kind of like work for hire for mm-hmm. filmmakers, and it's just to take to a pitch meeting. They're not being published. Mm-hmm. You know, they print on demand 50 of them to give to, you know, each of these meetings that they go to, but that's all they are. It's just, I guess, so the person that they want money from doesn't have to visualize it. You know, it's like, here it is. This is uh-huh. the blueprint. And, you know, that's fine. I see. Yeah, it's a commercial application. It'd right. be work for hire illustration.
So if you're listening to this, Jim Rugg would like an independent filmmaker to contact him about this great idea he has.
I don't have any work that would be a good example of it, but maybe I could recommend somebody's. I don't know.
You're not ready for an aphrodisiac movie?
I don't know. I think Black Dynamite might be kind of close. I haven't seen that yet, but the reviews seem like it's the same mm-hmm. idea.
Yeah, actually, one of your pieces actually was adapted into a movie, though. There's a Street Angel short film out of Australia.
Right.
How did that sort of come about, and did you have any interaction with that? Or
The guy contacted me. It seemed like an easy deal. You know, mm-hmm. I talked to the people that represent us, and they said that was fine, just it couldn't be sold commercially or anything like that. And he was very enthusiastic, so we signed off on that, and I was really happy with the results, but creatively we didn't have much input, mm-hmm. you know. And, he did follow our comic very closely, which was uh-huh. great. And it reminded me a lot of the Batman, the 60s Batman show, mm-hmm. because it was low budget, but,
right.
you know, and a little campy, and it was a lot of fun to watch.
Well, Street Angel's a little campy, too. So.
Absolutely, yes. That wasn't negative.
Yeah, it's really only available on the festival circuit at the moment. I mean, there's a trailer for it online, which is a lot of fun.
Right.
But the deal is they can't sell, so no DVD release or anything like that.
Right.
Tragic. That looks like a lot of fun.
I might try to show it some at shows mm-hmm. Or signings or something. I'm going to be doing a lot more shows this year mm-hmm. in support of One Model Nation and Aphrodisiac and Street Angel's back in print, so I had cut back on shows for a couple uh-huh. of years, but this coming year I'm going to be out a lot, so I might try to have some screenings mm-hmm. for people that are interested. We showed it at the Center for Cartoon Studies
uh-huh.
a couple of months ago. It's kind of funny. Steve Bissette does like a movie night, so we got to watch it with Fears of the Dark and a few other movies.
Fine. So let's talk about Street Angel for a second. Street Angel is, like you said, back in print, and you've actually returned to the Street Angel universe, if you will, with Aphrodisiac, upcoming graphic novel from Ad House. And why did you choose to come back with Aphrodisiac as opposed to a Street Angel follow-up, a direct Street Angel follow-up?
It was very organic. We did the first Aphrodisiac appearance was Street Angel number 5, simultaneously with Ad House's Project Superior. Like, they came out literally the same exact day.
Oh, uh-huh.
And what happened was, we were asked to be in Project Superior, and we were coming up with a story and came up with an Aphrodisiac story. It was in color, so that was a lot of fun. I think it might have been the first story we did in color. And since then, we have just been doing Aphrodisiac stories in the anthologies. So the book is... probably about half of the book is a collection of the different anthology short stories. So it wasn't something that we sat down in the last year and said, hey, let's do an Aphrodisiac mm-hmm. book. It was more something that we've been doing since Street Angel, of like, here's an Aphrodisiac story and here's one. And we just got to the point that we thought we had enough for a collection.
Mm-hmm.
The character, I'm not sure. He's very different than Street Angel. You know, Street Angel is a loser things, you wouldn't want to be her. Things right. tend to go wrong. People insult her. She has a terrible life. And with Aphrodisiac, he's this super alpha, he's a superhero, essentially. Right. He always wins. He defeats whatever threat is facing him. Always it's a very different character. Yes. Always gets the lady, has the great cars.
Ladies.
it's a very different character mm-hmm. dynamic than Street Angel. And, maybe that was why we started working on him, just as something different.
Mm-hmm. I had two takes on the Aphrodisiac book when I was reading it. And I kind of want to get your opinion on it, where you were coming from. On one hand, I read it as kind of a tongue-in-cheek love letter to the 70s, the blaxploitation films, the Jim Kelly, from Enter the Dragon with the great big afro and, taking three ladies a night and that kind of deal. And then also, I grew up, my favorite superhero growing up was Luke Cage, Power Man. I mean, back before Bendis made him cool. I mean, I had all the Power Man books. So on the one hand, I read it as a real love letter to that time. And there's, you do something great with the art in this where you print it in several different styles. You've mm-hmm. got you've got sort of the very, I think the first one is almost kind of a late 60s, sort of almost cartoony thing. And then you go into 70s, there's a little bit of an independent 80s look in there. So you do it in several different art styles throughout the book, and the printing quality also. There's different page types. You can see the pulp pages and all in there. So on the one hand, I read it that way, but on the other hand, I saw it as kind of an indictment of how black characters have been treated in, particularly in comic books, that they are these. I don't know. They all have either a criminal background or it seems almost limited. Like, if they don't have a criminal background, like I'm thinking Luke Cage, Power Man, sure. His whole thing is based around being, sort of on the outsides of a street gang and then going to prison, and then there's a prison experiment. Even the really positive ones, like Sam Wilson, who's the Falcon, he's the inner city counselor type deal, and it's... I noticed that at the top of several of your strips, you have the very old Marvel style of here's the background for it. And mm-hmm. it changes each time, right. which I thought was kind of interesting. It was so much fun to read those. But at the same time, I noticed that, he's either a janitor or one time he was a scientist, I think, but he was a janitor. One time he has an enchanted pimp cane. Right. There's lots of fun stuff. But at the same time, like I said, I read it as kind of an indictment of how black superhero characters just never really get that clean start that a lot of other characters get.
Like a Reed Richards.
Like a Reed Richards or a Tony Queen. Stark yeah. or, that kind of deal. And so, like I said, it could be read really easily both ways. I was just curious which approach you were taking. Because like I said, my first approach to it was this is a fun 70s type thing. And so...
Right. Okay. So this is about probably like an hour of explanation. No, the first thing is, there's no definitive way. Whatever mm-hmm. I intended, it doesn't matter what my intent right. was. It's really, however a reader responds to it is the right reaction. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a shortcoming in my storytelling if it's not the way I want a reader to react. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, that reaction's a genuine reaction. And, mm-hmm. With that said, a big part of it is, I was really going through a phase of just loving 70s comics, like the 70s Kirby stuff, mm-hmm. and then into the Marvel exploitation comics, like the horror comics that are just weird, mm-hmm. Son of Satan.
Yeah.
That's the strange, they're so strange, these concepts. The toy lines, like Rom, running uh-huh. for, I think, 80 issues or something. I was just fascinated with this era of yeah. comics for a big chunk of it. And that happened at the same time as a lot of books were being reprinted. And they were reprinted with like the Chip Kid, the high quality reproductions where you're getting the printing dots and the paper mm-hmm. blemishes and everything was visible. And I liked that aesthetic. So that was a lot of what informed, mm-hmm. I was choosing to work on this character a lot of times because I want to draw, I want to color it like a 70s book, or I want to uh-huh. try this idea I have, how to emulate that printing or whatever. So a lot of it was just tech stuff. It's the same as I was talking about the grid and One Model Nation as being, you know, from a creative point of view, something I was very interested in. So that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. As far as the anything you read about, like a reaction to black characters, it's possible that some of that's in there, like the same as One Model Nation being a reaction to art being co-opted for commercial reasons, or you know, people trying to use art to sell whatever. So there's probably some influence from like reading a bunch of that material, reading a bunch of the Luke Cages and thinking, well, that's not right. But I was also watching a lot of the blaxploitation movies, and I know those are, a lot of people don't consider those good movies, and some consider them negative racial, you know, stereotyping and things. But as movies, I think they're great. You know, you had a lot of young filmmakers who were getting their first chance to make these movies, and because the budgets were low, they were basically free to do whatever they wanted. And you can almost see that enthusiasm on the screen, you know, and where the budget, where you can see the budget dropping off, you can see like these guys just willing this vision into being. And I find that is like this positive, it's so great to see that, because, you know, I struggle to make comics, and it's that, like, you can see these guys are kind of struggling, but at the same time, they're ending up with something very exciting and dynamic and still entertaining 30 years later. And so that's inspirational. You know, that was something I found inspirational while I was working on the book. As characters, probably the problem with Luke Cage in the 70s, or the Falcon, or Black Lightning, is you have one black character or two black characters. They're not going to represent the black experience.
Right.
You know, if you only had one white character, he would not represent the white experience. You know, it was more of a limitation of a commercial medium that they either weren't able to sell well to an African-American audience, or didn't think they'd be able to sell well. You know, I'm not sure why there's only one or two black superheroes, but the limited number of superheroes, I think, is probably a bigger problem with, you know, this guy's a criminal background. Why isn't he a father of three, or, you know, a car salesman or a painter or whatever? And if you had 3,000 of these characters, it would probably be a little better representation. You would get a lot more of the diversity. So, I don't know if that exactly answers.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, I think you're right. I think that anyone can put whatever they want onto this. And that's one of the joys of reading Aphrodisiac, is that there's a lot of different experiences in the book. And I think that, you know, your interest in that time period really shows in the different, I don't know, they're not quite Easter eggs, but different things that you put in here, because you have, you know, covers to comics in here. Like, there's one that, Thor's looking at right now, which is kind of one of those Del Gold Key type ones where Aphrodisiac's being turned into Aphrodigi-Duck, I believe. Aphro-Duck. And, you know, and then there's one which, where it almost looks like a still from a Saturday morning cartoon.
Sure.
And so there's lots of these little things in there that really does capture the experience of that 70s Marvel or 70s even comic experience.
I'd like to know, on a process sort of question, how did you go about capturing that look for the old 70s style?
There are probably six or eight different processes at work in the book. That very first, the first story we ever did, I was scanning from the big Marvel Treasury editions. I would scan I'd find like a section of color, blue sky, you know, something that was as big of a section as I could find. And then I would duplicate that and create a large pattern, and I would fill areas with that color. I found, I'm friends with Frank Santoro. I don't know if you guys know his work. He does Cold Heat. And he's also kind of a process junkie. So he's done a lot of writing on various color techniques that are really fall, you know, like they're, like people just don't use them anymore, and they haven't been cataloged much, and he's cataloged a lot of those, so we talk about those. And from that I would get like color palettes, you know, like there was an interview with Neil Adams that he had written about, and Neil Adams talked about changing color. I think he was doing his own color for covers or something, and there were a bunch of colors that he wasn't allowed to use because they weren't allowed to overprint. The way it would work is you might have 50% magenta, 50% cyan, and you know, 50% yellow to make up a brown or something.
Right.
And you couldn't exceed 200% in coverage because the paper would slide on the presses, creating worse registration. And so the first thing Neil Adams did was colored something that had, that exceeded that 200% to see exactly what the printing result would be. And I just find that interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, when we did Street Angel, it started out as this angry reaction against Marvel and DC Comics that I was, as a reader, growing unsatisfied with. And by the time we finished the script on the first one and a lot of rewrites, it wasn't that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes so much energy to make a comic book. I can't imagine doing one that is just about loathing.
Right.
And with Aphrodisiac, it's the same thing. You know, like, this just happens to be all the stuff that I have been enjoying at the time. Mm-hmm. Some of the cover, you know, like just having a cover to indicate a Vietnam story with a dinosaur, right, or something like that. A lot of that comes from, like, there's the collected Batman animated art book, mm-hmm, that Chip Kidd and Bruce Timm and I don't know who else worked on it, but it's character sketches, it's you know, storyboards, it's pictures of the figures that came out of that series. Mm-hmm. And it's just this idea of, like, as a character, there's the character within a story, and then there's the character as, like, this icon. Mm-hmm. You know, Batman exists beyond whatever, getting his back broken by Bane. He exists as, like, a 60s TV show and a 90s cartoon and a movie and right, you know, and a comic book character and a kid's comic book character and, you know, Grant Morrison's version and all of this stuff. And I love that idea. I love that, mm-hmm, these characters, there's a reality to that character as an icon, and, mm-hmm, we were trying to capture some of that. So, you know, a lot of it was the Chip Kidd books. It was like the Plastic Man book that he did with Art Spiegelman. At the end, he does this mashup where he's taking panels out of context and creating this really strange narrative, mm-hmm, that I guess runs parallel to, you know, Jack Cole's suicide or something like that, or descent into depression maybe. And it's I don't really agree with what they did there, uh-huh, but I like the idea that as a storytelling medium, you could put a cover in and suggest this story. Mm-hmm. You know, I want it to be like you're looking out a window and you can kind of see a street going off, and then, you know, you hit the edge of your window, but you know that street continues, and because, right, you've had experiences driving around, you can imagine what might be beyond there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do that with the book. You know, I enjoy work that you read it and it suggests a more vast world, and I wanted to try to do that.
Well, I think you definitely succeeded with Aphrodisiac, because there were very few times in this story where I felt like, when I came to the end, where I felt like I'd had a complete story, in that, you know, like you were saying just now, like I'd come to the end of the road type deal. I always felt like there was either something that came before or something after, or there was a branch somewhere else. And because there's so many of those in this book, I feel like I'm like it's a window into a much larger world, especially when you get the, you know, covers with the, you know, dinosaur in Vietnam or whatever it is.
Well, even the cartoon, you know, if you look at, yeah, that cartoon image, there's a dog sidekick, uh-huh, and the girls are doing karate in the background. And we have an idea, like, you know, I mean, most of these ideas are a result of, we have ideas of what is the 80s aphrodisiac cartoon like. Mm-hmm. In our heads, we've got some of those, right, you know, and ideas of how to draw it and what the stories are. And it's much more shifted from, he's a pimp with you know, and these are his hookers, to he's this guy that's kind of Charlie's Angels, you know, right, he's a leader and they're like his strike team, you know?
Right.
It's, and like, you can almost see that happening on early 80s, actually all of 80s cartoons. You know, there's a Rambo cartoon that ran for, yeah, like a season, that's just bizarre.
Yeah.
It's so strange.
This book is like a story collage almost, like a mashup of all of these different styles.
Yeah, and part of that is a reaction. I did Heroes Con a couple of years ago in Charlotte. It's a great show. It's very comic centric, and guys were selling off back issues from the 70s really cheap. Mm-hmm. Huge runs, like, you know, all of the Eternals were like $1 each, and, mm-hmm, you know, old Frank Thorne Red Sonias and stuff like that. And a lot of people aren't interested in that. They, mm-hmm, want trade paperbacks. I guess, you know, you guys are trade, yeah, paperback review show, which is fine and that's great, but I grew up loving the individual, yeah, comics. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason, mm-hmm, that styles shift around, you know, in, right, the book. Because if you look at a comic from a different company, mm-hmm, in the 60s and another one from Marvel in the 70s, and, you know, DC's, mm-hmm, doing Baxter paper in the early 80s, they're very different. Mm-hmm. You know, the aesthetics of them are very different. And I wanted that stuff, mm-hmm, that I was just enjoying for the last 5 years.
Well, it's nice to sit down and do something that you enjoy. Because like you said, I mean, starting out with something that, you know, with Street Angel, where it's just this anger and reaction and rage to this, you're right. I mean, it's hard to sustain that, and it's hard to create something that's powerful because maybe not everybody feels that rage. Right. I mean, you know.
And I don't want to tell somebody. I think it's, you know, if you want to read just trade paperbacks, I think that's great. Mm-hmm. It makes no difference to me. Like, I would much rather hear somebody tell me about whatever book they just read that they love. I don't care what the format is. Right. I want to hear, oh, okay, why is it good? Mm-hmm. You know? Which is another thing that we were trying to do in Aphrodisiac is you often hear people talk about an old comic book story, right? Mm-hmm. Like everybody, you know, has some favorite old issue and they tell you about it and it sounds so good and you go out and get the issue and it never lives up to their story. And yeah. We wanted to do that, you know, like a lot of the short stories, that was the idea. Like, can mm-hmm. we maintain that high level, you know, cut out some of the subplots and maybe shorten it down to 6 pages or 8 pages right. and try to maintain that level of just, in, you know, enjoyable, like, oh, I can't believe this happened in this panel, mm-hmm. and, you know, keep that momentum going through these short mm-hmm. stories.
So what is your story? What is the story that we all should rush out and find that one issue of so that...
There's a great issue of Captain America, and I want to say it's issue 144, but it might be like 154. Mm-hmm. It's right around there. But it's easy to find. If you find it, it's a photograph of Captain America and the Falcon being torn in half. And the story is those guys breaking up, okay? Uh-huh. Gray Morrow draws part of it, and it's almost like a romance story, except with these two characters that were, you know, a team. Even to the point of Captain America at one point is kind of stalking the Falcon. He's on the fire escape outside the Falcon's apartment when Falcon comes home from a date. And he's like, you know, he's like peeping Tom, watching them finish their date or whatever. And whenever the girl leaves, Captain America comes in to confront him, like, you know, what are you doing with her? And you know, Falcon tells him, you know, he's on his own and goes into the back and changes his clothes to come out in his new flamboyant costume to show, look, I want to be my own man. Captain America goes home, falls asleep, and there's a full-page splash of him, like, sweating. He's having a nightmare, you know, about this breakup. It's a pretty fantastic issue.
So it's like the precursor to the bromance.
Yeah, it really is. That one's a good one. I like Kirby did a series, 2001, 10 issues of 2001. Mm-hmm. And I think it's issue 5 of that is a story called Comicville. And it's fantastic. It is about this guy in the future. There are virtual reality kind of like an arcade, except it's all virtual reality, and you show up and you decide what kind of storyline you want, what kind of, if you're rescuing a princess, you know, is she blonde, brunette, tall, short, whatever. Mm-hmm. All of these things you figure out, and then you plug into this game that's this lifelike experience, and you get to be a hero, superhero. It's an amazing story. It's almost a critique on that the fascistic, you know, aspects of being a superhero mm-hmm. are sort of critiqued. And it's an amazing story. I think it's one of the best Kirby comics, and you'll never see it reprinted because of I'm sure the rights and stuff for 2001 uh-huh. are difficult, but that's a really good standout issue. I think it's 2001 number 5. It might be number 4, but I think it's number 5.
See, that's the fun thing to you know, sit around and talk about comics, and you're right. I mean, I think that's something that's being lost in modern comics is everything's being written for the trade. It's very hard now to say, you know, this issue of now it's this run or this arc, in which, you know, in them there, you know, the overall arc might be good, but there's, you know, I don't know, it's hard to pick out a particular moment or something like that. And that's, yeah, going back and looking at comics that were just written and produced different for a different concept, a lot of fun. So what's next for you? I mean, so you've got One Model Nation, which is out right now. You've got Street Angel, which is back in print. Aphrodisiac is...
It'll probably be January. Mm-hmm. Some issues will be floating out this month. We've had some advanced shipped, so those will be going out. Mm-hmm. But most of them will be in January, I guess.
Okay. So what's coming up next?
The thing I'm working on now is I'm illustrating The Guild for Dark Horse. It's Felicia Day's web series. And that's the next big project that I'm working on. And it's about online gamers, and it's going to be split up into, part of it will focus on the characters outside of the game, and part of it will be more Conan-esque and fantasy about the characters in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really looking forward to that. It's a chance to draw in a little bit of a different style, a little bit of fantasy-influenced style,
mm-hmm.
which I for whatever reason, haven't done anything like that so far. So that's kind of exciting for me. And that's where most of my energy is focused right now. That and promoting the other books.
Well, I really appreciate you agreeing to come and sit down with us and talk about your books. Wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. So you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and comics. You can find us at stumptowntradereview.com or on iTunes. And you can, do you have a website you would like to promote?
Jimrug.com points at everything.
All right. Fantastic. Thanks, Mike. Kissing my roll up to the bumper and get out of the car. Buy some clothes and start another one, superstar. Chilling out.